Good morning. We're going to call the Senate Environmental Natural Resource Finance Committee to order, January 16th, 2019. Welcome to the committee members and folks in the audience. We've got a rather large agenda today to talk about a couple of different things. First of all, we're going to start out with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency talking about landfills. And I think the first testifier I have is Kathy Sather.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Happy New Year, happy session, and we're happy to be before you today.
Same to all of you.
Our first hearing of the 2019 session. So we're going to talk a little bit about two of our priority landfills that we were asked to update the committee on. One is the landfill in Anoka County in Andover, Minnesota, and the second one is the landfill in Burnsville. So just a little background to refresh your memory. You know, our motto is there's three ways to handle pollution. You can prevent it, you can manage it, or you can clean it up. Cleaning it up is always the most expensive. So we like to focus on prevention and management. And, of course, our mission is to protect public health and the environment. So just a little overview on the closed landfill program. This slide shows you the closed landfill ownership in the state and location of our closed landfills. You can see they're spread all over. The legislature created the closed landfill program in 1994. And the reason they created it was because there was a landfill in Washington County and it became a Superfund site, and then there became, with the Superfund process, under state and federal law, responsible parties have to be identified and have to pay for the cleanup. So then all this litigation started over who was responsible for what. And the legislature, in its wisdom, saw that this was going to be an expensive, time-consuming proposition for the taxpayer, and that it would be better if we could manage all our closed landfills in one program. So under this program, the state of Minnesota through the MPCA, we are responsible for managing up to 114 closed landfills that were permitted to hold mixed municipal solid waste. So this is not the construction and demolition landfills or others, and that are enrolled in the program. And our work at these landfills is to mitigate risks to the public and the environment. And then we install systems to mitigate, to protect the water and the air and so forth. So today there's 110 of those 114 landfills that are enrolled in the program. So just point of reference, those 114, you might ask, well, why them? There's got to be more landfills than that. And there are. But those 114 at the time were chosen because from that point forward, landfills were all required to have financial assurance. Those 114 had varying levels of financial assurance. So the legislature directed us to do a negotiation with their insurance companies to get a broad settlement for all of them, and we did that. So there's 110 enrolled today, and we're going to talk about two of them. Just a little bit more about how we decide which ones are the top priority out of those 110. Every year we go through a ranking process to look at all of our landfills, and we evaluate them on the presence and degree of hazards. So what could possibly damage the groundwater, the surface water? What about the methane that comes off of all landfills? Excuse me, all mixed municipal solid waste landfills. What are the conditions geologic there and otherwise that might make those hazards even more dangerous? How likely is the public to be exposed and other factors? And then we assign values to all of those through a process, and then that's how we come up with what are the highest priorities to protect public health and the environment. So again, today we're going to look at two of those closed landfills. The first one is the Waste Disposal Engineering Landfill, or we call it WDE for short. And that's in Andover in Anoka County. And I'm going to turn it over to our staff, but first I'll tell you about these pictures. So the picture that looks older with the on the left-hand side there, that's a picture of some of the barrels that were disposed at this site back in the early 1970s. And then the picture at the right is a more recent picture of some of the contaminated soil from that site.
Ms. Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman?
Could you give, you know, the years I've been listening to this, I never hear the age or the time factors involved in these landfills, specifically now the 110 closed landfills. What is the approximate age? How many years have they been? Do you even have that? Do you consider that in your analysis?
Yes.
And then the history of trespass. Why don't you talk to me a little bit about that?
Thank you for those questions, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Sather, our Remediation Division Director, who may have that or may not. I don't know.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Kathy Sather. I'm the Director of the Remediation Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And is your question about what is the age of the sites and the disposal that occurred? Or
yes, the average age of those sites. How many years have we, the state of Minnesota, or the county, whoever, the agency, been allowing solid waste to be put in there?
The history that I have shows that a lot of the dumping for most of these landfills was done probably in the 60s and 70s, and that these were then closed later on when the closed landfill program was created in 1994. So a lot of them actually closed like even in the 80s. This landfill itself closed back in, I think it was
I guess we don't have the exact date that the landfill closed, because this one is kind of unique because it has the hazardous waste pit. But I will get that information for you, Mr. Chairman, about when these landfills started accepting waste and when they closed in the closed landfill program.
And then
trespass?
Yeah, the history of trespass.
Okay. Got that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to provide an update on the WD landfill in Andover. What we're looking here is it is a third acre of a hazardous waste pit that we're really focusing on, and that's noted in the red circle in the middle of the map, and the orange line that goes around the landfill is the current waste footprint. But the hazardous waste pit is really the source that we need to spend some time on. This is something that, as Greta noted, we had that first picture that showed the barrels that were disposed of in 1973 that are just sitting there wide open in a spot in the land. And obviously, over time, that has caused some environmental issues. There were 6,600 barrels that were disposed of over that two-year time frame. We have significant source of groundwater contamination at the landfill. There's residential drinking wells that are present near the site. Those have all been sampled, and they are safe at this point in time and are not impacted, but they are potential receptors. We also, within the last year, identified four private wells that were in close proximity to the site, and we have sampled those, and at this point in time, they are not currently impacted either. This site is really expensive to operate for treating the contamination. We're spending about $600,000 a year in order to do that. So our expectation would be that when we excavate the buried drums and remove the waste, that we'd have a significant source of cost savings due to the long-term O&M costs.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just point out at the bottom of the picture, you can see those are some baseball diamonds where Little League plays in the summer. And to the left of the picture where you see the residential, just to the left of that, there is a high school with outdoor track and outdoor facilities and so forth.
So when you're looking at the waste footprint, how far away, I mean, is there waste right next to the ball field here? And that's been going on for quite some time, the dumping of solid waste there? Or are we only targeting just the red circle area?
Hi, my name is Jamie Wallerstedt, and I work with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'm the supervisor on these two projects. Mr. Chair, The orange line is actually the waste footprint, and that's the landfill itself. And the red circle is the actual hazardous waste pit that we are looking to remove. So that waste footprint has been in place since the 1980s.
Mr. Chairman, is there a plume of water from the hazardous waste pit, I think is what we're trying to...
Yep, there is groundwater contamination entering the groundwater, and then it flows to the north, kind of northeast, so not towards the ball fields, towards Coon Creek.
Okay. My next question would be the obvious. How long ago since the ball fields were built?
We'll get that information,
yeah,
Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. All right, please proceed. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're showing in this picture here is just a cross-cut of what the actual hazardous waste pit looks like. Over time, the liner has completely dissolved, and under that we have soil that is contaminated, that's saturated with hazardous waste, and that's 20 feet below that. And below that, the groundwater has been impacted. So for this site, we have received previous funding to work on the site. We initially received $650,000 back in 2016 from the general fund to do some initial work at the site. In 2017, we received bonding dollars in the amount of $11.35 million. Last year, when we did additional investigation on the site, we found that there was more waste that we needed to deal with, and it was going to cost more for us to do that, so we came back and requested an additional $6 million, and an appropriation was made for that, but it was made out of the appropriation bonds. And at this point in time, those bonds have not been issued. There is a potential lawsuit that is going to potentially happen with litigation, so the Department of MMB has not gone ahead and sold those bonds. So we certainly, at this point in time, have not been able to look at actually awarding construction contracts. We do have a construction bid that came in December, and that did come in $4.3 million over and above the $6 million that we already had. The reasons for those cost increases were projections in the bidding for the cost of the building that's going to be built on site, that's going to be built over the hazardous waste as it's removed. There was going to be additional costs for the liner, and there was also going to be additional costs for actually hauling the waste away and then what it would be to dispose of the waste. So at this point in time, we are looking at, in order to actually move forward and do the construction and finish the work at the site, that an additional $10.3 million will be needed. And at this point in time, it's unsure, you know, the timing of when that $6 million in appropriation bonds will actually be resolved. But we do know the neighbors are very interested in the cleanup. Our plans were that if we could get the construction contracts awarded by the end of February, that we would be able to do the work in the fall and actually complete the work in 2019. But if it's delayed beyond that February date, then we will likely have to delay the cleanup activities until the following year.
So you're saying that the $11.35 million from general obligation bonds, you cannot do any contracting with those dollars at all?
Mr. Chairman, MMB general requires that projects cannot start construction until all the funding has been appropriated and provided for. So we do not have all that at this point in time. One other point I'll make is this is one of my favorite pictures from this landfill because this is another soil sample taken just to see that it's not often that you see purple soil, but this is what we took from this landfill about a year ago.
Excuse me, Ms. Gauthier. Senator Tomasoni.
So go back to that picture because I wanted you to explain the tape measure. Oh. I was wondering what the tape measure is doing there and what it actually is. And then back to the chairman's question. So are you saying that the $6 million appropriation bonds, in addition to the $11.35 million general obligation bond, are a total cost and that you can't do the project without the $6 million? Is that what you're saying?
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Tomasoni, let me take your second question first. So recall last year we came in with this situation where we had gotten the $650,000 and then the $11.35 bonding, and we started the work because we thought it was a $12 million cleanup. and we got into the site and started uncovering where these barrels are, and we found that the contamination was far more widespread than we had been able to understand up until that point. So it's not unusual for us to do our best to delineate the contamination, but when we get in and open it up, then we can see what's really going on. So we found out that there was a lot more soil that was contaminated and that that upper aquifer there of groundwater was contaminated. Fortunately, there is a barrier wall all the way around the pit, but we are going to have to excavate a lot more than we thought we were, and that was why we needed the additional $6 million. So we did get appropriate funding for that through the appropriation bonds last year, backed by the Environmental Trust Fund. That money is now tied up because of a lawsuit, and the MMB has said they will not sell those bonds until the lawsuit is concluded or withdrawn or somehow resolved. So what we're saying is that we got our bids in, and it's on top of the $6 million, now we need it's going to cost another $4.3 million because of the cost of hauling and disposing of this contamination. And mainly because the building, we have to build a structure over the pit to contain the vapors and other contamination during excavation. We had thought that building could be built out of pre-made kind of components, but we now have learned that it cannot, and it will have to be custom built around. And then we're circulating the air inside that building like, I don't remember how many, 10 times an hour or something like that, so to protect the workers who are working there who will also be in hazmat suits. So the cost came in higher than we anticipated, but that's where it stands today now, is that with the $6 million tied up in court and the additional $4.3 million needed because of increased costs, we need an additional $10.3 million to conduct this cleanup. And we need the money by the end of February in order to do the cleanup in the fall and winter of 1920, which the community wants the cleanup done in the winter time because they don't want it done when people have their windows open or kids are playing outside. So otherwise, if the funding comes by the end of session, then we'll clean it up in the winter of 2021.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you answered my question.
Okay.
So
sorry.
I think the chairman asked you a question if the $11.35 million was issued, and I think you said no. And I'm wondering if that is because the $6 million and the $4.3 million are part of the total project. And so has the $11.35 been issued, and have you used that money?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tomasoni. The $11.35 million in bonds were sold, and that money was available to us to start the cleanup in July of 2018, and we did in 2017.
Isn't that what you asked?
Yeah.
July of 2017. So, yes, the $11.3 million is available to us.
And who are these people who are suing over cleanup, right? It seems to me that's a good use of the money. Anyway, you don't have to answer that.
I'm sorry. Ms. Gauthier, you said that, so there is some going on now. There is some contracting going on with the 11.35.
Mr. Chairman and members, so again, we got the total of $12 million in 16 and 17. 650 of that, 1,000 of that was the general fund, the rest was bonding. MMB sold those bonds, the funds were available, we got the okay to start the work, and we started the cleanup. And we got in there and found out it was worse than we thought and was going to cost $6 million more. So the legislature provided that $6 million in funds from the sale of appropriation bonds backed by the Environmental Trust Fund. Those bonds, the $6 million bonds, have not been sold.
That's right. Senator Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to continue along so that I can wrap my head around this, you've spent the $11.35 and the $650,000.
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Simonson, we started to spend it, and then we had to stop because we needed additional funds to complete the project. And so we came back to the legislature to get the additional funds because now instead of a $12 million project, it was an $18 million project. We got those funds appropriated, but the bonds were not sold. So I can get back to you with how much of the $11.35 and $650,000 we have spent, but we have not spent it all.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So I understand now a portion of that 2016 and 2017 appropriation remains available.
Yes.
But you are saying that you need an additional 10.3 in GO bonds, presumably by the end of February, in order to complete this project in a timely fashion?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simonson, yes, because under state bidding rules, after the end of February, we will have to rebid the project. So we will have to start the bidding process all over again. And that will take about a year.
Mr. Chair, I think the thing to think about here, too, is if this goes beyond that time period and they have to start over again, I would guess that they will come back and tell us the costs have only gone up. I don't know how you can. That's a pretty heavy lift to find that kind of money by the end of February.
Let's just hope the judge makes his decision really quickly. Senator Abler, new member, you got a question.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm glad to be here, and I'm happy I showed up today, Mr. Chair.
This very is very nice you showed up today. Yes, thank
you. Thanks for having me, and it's a real pleasure to have a fifth committee and get to enjoy learning about my backyard. This is in my district, and I remember going there as a little kid, dropping off screen doors with my dad in the landfill, and it seemed like such a great idea at the time. I did not have anything to do with the barrels, though. We didn't do that. But I'm just wondering who thought that was a good idea to put an asphalt thing under solvents. But just to reiterate, thanks for all your work on this. And this is your number one thing, I think, isn't it? Is it, Ms. Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Abler, yes, WD Landfill is our number one priority.
All right. And so there is an effort with the other body to see if that we couldn't conjure up a one-item bonding bill to do this. And so I think everybody agreed, oh, we should get this done, but then I think we'll see how other things want to get done as well. So to represent Senator Simonson's point, I hope we can pull it off. There is a plume, and there's a creek, and nobody should go in that creek. I'm not sure if you're supposed to say that here, but it's a good place not to go swimming. It kind of caught a lot of people by surprise, and there was efforts to get it done, and so it's just pain for somebody's past sins. Thanks.
So, yes, Senator, just a little brief backup, if you will. I co-chair the LCCMR along with other folks, and this was an emerging issue, obviously, and that's why they came to LCCMR for some funding, and that's why the committee agreed to do this, and not only the committee but also the House in very, very bipartisan fashion, along with the Senate, voted for this, and the governor signed it. So it was addressed in a very quick fashion. However, now there's some folks that are having problems with, understanding that, the difference in the Constitution, the wording of the Constitution. This is actually dealing with potential clean water issues. And that, of course, was the previous administration's big thing was, as we all should in Minnesota, be caring about clean water. And it has been addressed, and now it's been tied up in court. So it's really unfortunate. But that's where it is.
Mr. Chair, go ahead. And I wasn't implying that was a sin. I was talking about the sins of the dumpers at the site. But and I appreciate the attention of the LCCMR to this and what fully funding what they thought was necessary. And I'll just have one more question. So do you have any idea how much it might go up if we don't get this done this year? Is it another 10% or something? Or do you have a random thought?
Mr. Chairman, we don't know. I'm sorry.
Okay. Any other questions so far?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on to the next landfill, freeway landfill and dump in Burnsville. This is our number two priority, closely following behind WDE landfill, for needing to be addressed. So I'll orient you on the map here for those of you from the area or might know the area. The river on the left is the Minnesota River, and this photograph is looking to the east. So then you can see 35W crossing the Minnesota River there. So this landfill is that green area just at the intersection of the river, and 35W would be the southwest quadrant of that intersection. There's also a dump associated with this landfill, and that is across the freeway Kitty Corner. You can see that. There's a quarry south of the landfill owned by Kramer Quarry. Then there's an open and existing landfill. Burnsville Landfill is an open landfill accepting waste. And then you can see the shaded blue area there is the Burnsville and Savage drinking water supply area. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kathy.
Thanks, Greta. And as Greta said, and she talked about early on in her presentation, is that the closed landfill program does have a priority risk scoring system, and both WDE and Freeway are at the top of the list, and as far as in need of cleanup activity, and again, scoring-wise, these are far above any of the other remaining on the list, so it's really important that we address these. So this is a chart that really shows a little bit more close-up picture of what the freeway landfill and the freeway dump look like. Freeway dump was added to this in 2017 through additional legislation. We've got the freeway dump, obviously, is a lot smaller. It's only 28 acres and operated from 61 to 71. Freeway landfill operated 69 to 90, 150 acres, obviously a lot more waste. It's 5 million cubic yards compared to the million at the dump. They're both unlined landfills, and they do, as Greta mentioned, they're close to the drinking water source for both Burnsville and Savage. And as a lot of dumps and landfills in the past, in the 60s, 70s were done, they were built on wetlands adjacent to rivers, so at that point in time, there obviously it was unknown what future impacts that these landfills would have, but obviously that is a concern at this point. And this is just something that just shows you the kind of the timeline over when the property was originally acquired in the mid-1960s. Waste disposal began in 69. There was actually a permit that was issued by the MPCA in 1971. There was some federal legislation for the Federal Resource Conservation Recovery Act that managed hazardous waste. That was passed in the late 70s. The freeway landfill was actually added to the Federal Superfund site in 1986. We had solid waste rules that were created in 88, and then in 1990, freeway landfill stopped accepting waste. But this is one of the eligible landfills in the closed landfill program that still has not entered the program. With a binding agreement.
Oh, okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, the legislation in 2017 did give us authority to begin the cleanup, and we do not have a binding agreement, but for an all intents and purposes, we have started the cleanup work on this site.
So this is just to kind of give you some background information as far as really what's happening at the site, as far as kind of what's the historical flow, what's the current flow, and what's the future impacts. So let's start with the historical. So before the landfill existed, the site was on a wetland. The groundwater flowed mainly to the Minnesota River, and obviously today's regulations would never allow a landfill to be built on such a site. So what's happening today? We've got Kramer Quarry that pumps a large amount of money. Excuse me, money.
Water,
up to 10 million gallons per day from the landfill. And this is essentially acting as kind of the treatment system for the landfill so that the water isn't escaping and causing future contamination. The pumping actually lowers the water table, and then that prevents the waste in the freeway landfill from sitting directly in groundwater and causing contamination to the groundwater at this point in time. But in the future, we are anticipating that Kramer Quarry will stop pumping at some point in the future. When that does happen, we're anticipating that the groundwater will again flow towards the Minnesota River, and then it'll flow through the landfill, which means that it would flow through the waste that's in the landfill and would have future impacts to both the river and then the lake and potentially the drinking water sources for Burnsville and Savage. So what we're looking at also is the waste and leachate at the bottom of the landfill would have direct contact with the water and, again, have the contamination issues for the future.
And I think the point of this slide, too, Mr. Chairman and members, is that to understand that the waste in the landfill goes all the way down to the bedrock. And there's no liner. It just goes straight down to the bedrock. So the groundwater will flow right through that waste and into the Minnesota River when the quarry stops pumping. And this gives you a picture of what our modeling projects, how that water would flow underwater, the groundwater.
So we did do a lot of investigation during the year this year to try to figure out what's really going on at the landfill. And again, we were focused more in the boundaries of both what's investigation of the landfill and the dump. And we did find, that methane is detected. It's above the lower explosive limit. We do have a number of sources of contamination in the groundwater above health standards, including 1,4-dioxin. PFCs, which again is a contaminant of concern that we're dealing also with in the East Metro area. It's got VOCs and metals. And then with the contamination on site is also exceeding the surface water criteria. So we have found a lot of information on site of items in the landfill that do cause concern and are above standards. So where we're at currently is we have received funding for investigation at the Freeway Landfill. We received an appropriation for $3 million in 2017 out of the Closed Landfill Investment Fund. And this is just for the preliminary investigation and design work. And our thoughts at that time was that the total project was going to cost about $90 million for cleanup. Now that the freeway dump has been added to the project, and with what we're found in the initial investigation, we're looking at least probably $100 million of what the cost of the total cleanup would be going into the future. We also, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and members, we will, one of the things we will be asking for this year is a change in the available to spend language on that $3,217,000 or 2017 appropriation. It's taken us longer to spend that than we thought because we've had a delay over getting access to the property. We had to go to court to get that. It didn't actually go to court. We got the agreement to have access the day before we were supposed to be in court, but that did delay our work. So we have not completely spent the $3 million from 2017, so we would like that available until date to be moved out a little bit. So you'll see that language when our budget comes forward.
Can you explain a little bit to me why $90 million versus $100 million and a little
Sure.
bit less than a two-year period?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So there's a few reasons why the costs went up. One is because of what we found in there. So we found things like 1,4-dioxin, volatile organics, PFAS or the PFCs, and those are all going to be, they add a cost because of work that we have to do to address them. We did not know that those contaminants were in there, but we have now found them, and that will add cost to the cleanup. Also, if you recall, we at one point thought that we might be able to encapsulate the dump in site and not have to move it. But recall when we last came before the committee with the appropriation, we had no information about what was in the freeway dump. So we got information about what was in the freeway dump, and it is contaminated enough that we are not going to be able to encapsulate it on site. But rather, the engineering consulting firm that works with us is saying we need to take that waste and put it on the landfill and encapsulate it all together. So there will be the cost of moving that waste around, above, under the freeway over to the landfill. That's the second thing that's driving costs. And the third thing that's driving the costs is that we still haven't identified the boundaries for the waste at the site. So usually, as you can see, the orange lines up there are the boundaries that we have for our permits. But when we got out and started walking those lines, we realized that there was waste beyond those boundaries. So then we, if you look on the north side there, right, between the boundary and the Minnesota River, there's a private company there, U.S. Salt. So we have just gotten the legal documentation agreed upon with them so that we can move on to their property and determine whether the waste, how far it continues. On the dump, the property to the east of the dump or the right of the dump is owned by, some of that is by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so we're working with them to get permission to go on their property to see how far beyond the boundary the waste extends. So we're still, we didn't anticipate the cost of extra work to define the boundary, so that is an added cost. So those are the three: new contaminants, having to move the dump, and having to find the boundaries.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, and I think that's what Greta explained is, you know, we are requesting to extend the date for the $3 million to be spent as available, just because of the fact that we do have additional work we need to do with the second phase of investigation. And as Greta mentioned also, we are looking off-site, and that's our big thing. Is we don't know where the boundary of the waste currently ends, so we need to find out what's the true extent and magnitude of the waste so we have a better idea of what we're dealing with and what we actually have to clean up and remove from the site. So it is all the property owners that Greta mentioned, in addition to Xcel Energy is another one that we'll be working with as well, to get access to do additional investigation on their property. So it's the field sampling and our, you know, we're working with those outside parties to currently get access. And once we get access, we're hoping to start that work of investigation, hopefully within the next couple weeks, and then have results back shortly thereafter to give us a better idea, probably within about a month of the when the actual samples, to get a better idea of really what's happening at the site. And that'll give us a better idea as far as what needs to be done, which will then inform us what's really going to be the true cost to actually work on cleaning up the site. We also, because of the fact that this was previously a federal Superfund site, and we will need to do additional work for documentation in accordance with federal CERCLA to as we move forward in the site. So that will take a little more time than we had originally anticipated as well. So that's the second to the last bullet where we say we need to meet EPA-required remediation investigation feasibility study requirements. And then we'll need to complete the design for the landfill and dump response action plan. At this point in time, our current schedule.
I don't think
that's on there.
Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
No, it's not on there, but just to share with you kind of what our current schedule is. So we're beginning the additional investigation this month, and that our hopes then would be that we would have enough information in the spring where we could have a public meeting in April and share our proposed plan sometime in the summer, but the actual cleanup activities would likely not occur until late 2020.
So just a real quick question in the second from the last bullet point.
Mm-hmm.
You may have said the time on that. How long does those feasibility studies take, roughly?
Mr. Chair, the EPA-required remedial investigations and feasibility studies vary depending on if EPA is available to review them, because they will have to concur with that. But we are anticipating that we'll be able to complete that in the next six to eight months.
Okay, any questions? Senator Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Gauthier. So, thank you for all you've done in this. We've been working on this for a long time, and I'm excited that we've gotten to this point, because for a while we didn't think we were even going to get this far. But so I guess my concern is when I look at this and I look at your map, so we're going to be taking the landfill and the dump, and we're going to take the toxic waste from that and put it in the Burnsville landfill, which is really next to the river and which is downriver from, or down, just down from the Burnsville. So we're removing that. What precautions are we taking that from 20 years from now we're going to go, why did we think that was a good idea? I mean, because we're not really moving it very far from the water sources and the Burnsville water intake area. So what kind of precautions do we have that we're just, and we're going to move all this, but it seems to me we're just putting, we're not moving it very far, and are we in danger of creating the same circumstance down the road?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rood, so there's a couple different things happening about the future freeway landfill right now. Our plan that our contract engineer is working on has been to encapsulate the waste on site, to not move it, except to move the dump over to the landfill. And so what the plan is over a five-year period, we section by section would dig up the waste and then line and then put the waste back on that lined area, dig up the next chunk and so forth until the whole thing is lined, and then to encapsulate the entire thing on site so that there would no longer be waste at the freeway dump, but there would be waste at the landfill. You may have been contacted by others, but another business in the area, the Kramer Quarry, is also talking about another possible strategy for dealing with the waste, and I'm not qualified to present their proposal, except to say that they had brought that to us last year, and that Kirk Kadalka from our staff, the assistant commissioner that handles this, has met with them multiple times, and we're trying to understand what their costs would be. My understanding generally is that they would rather not encapsulate on site, but take all of that waste to the currently open Burnsville landfill. And so to answer your question about if that were done, what would the precautions be, I don't have that information with me, because our plan has always been to encapsulate on site, but I can certainly try to get that information for you. Yep.
Any other questions, members, about the freeway landfill? Members, what I'm going to do, and before that, Ms. Gauthier, if you would so indulge myself and the lead with copies of the bid copies. I don't know if we've ever seen those before, with regards to the WDE landfill. If you could stop by with those, we could take a look at them or make copies of them. Is that something you've done in the past, or can we take a look at those? They seem to be fluctuating an awful lot, and we'd just like to take a look at them.
Mr. Chairman, staff are telling me that that document is not public information right now, but once the contract is signed, is issued, once the contract is issued, then we'd be more than happy to do that.
Okay, thank you. No further questions, members. I'm going to switch the thank you very much for that report. Switch the calendar around here, or the agenda around. We're going to go right to the True Shrimp discussion. Senator Dames is here. He's got other commitments, and I asked him to be here today. So with that, I don't think there'll be too much of a problem. I think all the folks that are here are, with regards to that topic, Jeff Smith and Shannon Lothammer, if you'd come forward, I guess, and we'll start in with your testimony. So whoever wants to start, go ahead. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the Pollution Control Agency. Kind of ahead of the True Shrimp conversation, we were anticipating some questions about the PCA's activities serving businesses across the state of Minnesota. So we wanted to give you one slide quickly two slides to talk about kind of where we're at today, again, in anticipation of questions you may have.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Smith. Respect for Mr. Senator Weber, do you have any comments starting with here at all, or would you just as soon wait? Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just quickly on this slide here, we've got 18,000 air, water, and land permits that the MPCA manages, and we issue about 25 to 3,000 of those permits every year. As was set up in 2011, we've got statutory goals for us to issue those permits. We've got a 90-day goal for simple permits. We've got a 150-day goal for the more complex permits. And we've got a 210-day goal for municipal wastewater permits. Since 2011, we've been working very hard to streamline our permitting services. A couple of things that we've done that are notable today is we've got a brand-new permitting database called Tempo. This system will allow us to input, collect, and issue permits much faster. The old software that we were using was antiquated and really was not serving us well. So we spent about 5 years getting this system up and running, so it really is going to be a very speedy and productive use of our permitting staff and helpful for our permitting staff. Another part of that Tempo system was the implementation design and implementation of about 80 online services. The world is moving to online services, and so we're trying to keep up with that. So we've got 80 services we put into place over the last few years. This will allow regulated parties, businesses, individuals, cities to input their permitting data, including permit applications, as well as monitoring data right back into our permitting system instead of the paperwork exchange that was how we did our old system. So these 80 online services are really speeding up both how we process data, how we accept data, and how we're able to turn around permitting permits in a much faster way. Another thing that we've put into place.
Mr. Smith, excuse me, Senator Tomassoni.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just real quickly, can you just give us an example of a simple permit and a complex permit?
Absolutely, Mr. Okay. Chair, Mr. Members. So simple permits for us are the ones that are generally general permits. A general permit is one permit that covers a number of facilities, usually from 15 to 20 to a few hundred permits. So for us, it's easy because we get to public notice one permit. It's in place for 5 years, and it will cover facilities that are the same across the state of Minnesota. So examples of that are construction stormwater permits, our industrial stormwater permits. We've got some wash facility permits that are general permits. For permittees, it's very fast because the application is very simple, usually a page or two, and we can issue general permits within a couple of days to a couple of weeks. So that's a very simple general permit that fall into that 90-day category. The more complex permits are the ones that you can imagine are the larger, more complex, often controversial permits that require individual permits, so one permit for each site. That's our more complex permits. The 210-day goal is for wastewater facility permits. That was set up a couple of years back and was specifically there because oftentimes the cities actually requested this because their process of getting through and finding consultants, doing the technical work, and getting through city council meetings takes more time. So they asked if they could be included in a different category and that if that category for the goal would be a little bit longer.
Mr. Chairman, can you be a little bit more specific on the complex permits?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Those permits are things like mining permits certainly fall into that category. Ethanol facilities fall into that category. Mid-sized manufacturing, beet sugar facilities. It's about 200, well, on the air side, it's about 200 of the facilities that we work with fall into that category of the thousands that we issue just on the air side. I was just going to finish up with a couple of things that we've done to try to speed up our permitting process over the last couple of years. We have created a web-based system with some more information and technical assistance so applicants can go in, look at their process on the website, get some assistance in filling those applications out, and then contact us. One of the things that's really helpful for us and for them is to have that face-to-face contact ahead of them submitting applications. So we can scope the project, help them understand what permits requirements will be applicable to them, and maybe even get them down into a simpler permit, which is better for all of us and certainly is much faster. So that's just a couple of examples that we've been using to kind of speed up the overall process. On this slide, you can see how we've been doing. We meet our permit issuance goals for all permits 93% of the time. That's all of our air, water, and land permits. I think more importantly for this discussion around business is that we meet our permit timeliness goals 90% of the time for priority construction permits. So those permits that impact jobs, growth, and business for businesses that want to grow or expand or are brand new to the state of Minnesota, we issue those permits and meet our timeliness goals 90% of the time. So while that's good news, we're pretty proud of that number. We've worked really hard to achieve that. We know that there's more to do. And so we've already got in place a process that we're implementing right now to even speed up our processes further, including more online services. We want to work with business sectors directly. We have been spending time doing that, and we want to spend more time understanding their needs, what they want us to work on, talk about streamlining permit language, and then making sure that we are both protecting human health and the environment, as well as serving our valuable Minnesota business industry. The second slide I was going to point out is another service that the state of Minnesota provides, the Minnesota Business First Stop. This was charged by the Dayton administration early on in the governor's administration. It was a way for the governor to get all of nine state agencies, agriculture, commerce, deed, labor industry, DNR, revenue, transportation, the MPCA, and the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board together to address the need that we were hearing, that the governor was hearing at the time, for us to be supportive and to be out in front of the Minnesota business community. Again, a desire for us to serve those new businesses well. So these nine agencies and these commissioners get together once a month. A staff team, of which I'm part of, gets together twice a month and works through and provides assistance to businesses that may be interested in growing and building here in Minnesota. It's sort of a one-stop shop to understand all the regulatory requirements and for us to be able to engage with that business early and often to help them navigate the regulatory requirements here in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. And in the interest of time, let's move right to the City of Luverne issue with the TruShimp, if we could, because we are under, we do have another topic that we want to talk about. So if you can move right into that, that would certainly help us out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So I'll talk about how the Pollution Control Agency is working with the City of Luverne regarding both the city's needs and then this particular economic development. So my name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Pollution Control Agency. And the PCA absolutely recognizes the importance of new industrial startups in not just the City of Luverne, but in cities and towns across Minnesota. Mr. Smith just talked about some of the ways that we work with these new businesses to bring them into the state and help them navigate the various opportunities and permitting that is part of our process. In the case of the TruShimp facility, they were looking at locating one of their harbors, and they still are looking at locating one of their harbors in the City of Luverne or discharging to the City of Luverne's wastewater treatment facility. So often when we have new businesses come to the state of Minnesota, they are actually looking to construct their own wastewater treatment and discharge from that wastewater treatment into waters of the state. In that case, they need to get a permit directly from the Pollution Control Agency as a part of that. But in some cases, and in this case, that's the case, a business is looking to do some treatment within their facility, but then discharge to an existing wastewater treatment facility. So that is the case with the City of Luverne. The City of Luverne is looking at expanding their wastewater treatment plant to accommodate some upcoming economic growth within the city. It's both to accept wastewater from the premium Iowa pork plant that is being proposed to be built outside the City of Luverne. And then also TruShimp is proposing to be a smaller discharger, sending wastewater to the City of Luverne. So the city needed increased wastewater treatment capacity in order to accept that additional waste and address that in their current facility. The city has an ambitious goal for that wastewater treatment plant expansion of constructing that plant in the summer of 2019. And so working towards that goal, the city applied for a permit to expand their wastewater treatment plant in September of 2018, so just this past September. So we've had numerous meetings with the city to talk through their wastewater treatment plant needs and expansion plans and to address what are the information needs that we have to review that plan, what might be some of the approaches that need to be taken in that expansion and in their permit. And that culminated most recently in a letter in December of 2018, which provided a bulleted list of the relevant steps that need to be completed before the wastewater treatment plant is expanded. So again, we're committed to those two goals of economic growth and environmental protection. Absolutely, we know that the city wants to conduct their wastewater treatment plant expansion in a way that meets that goals, and we have been working towards that effort with the city. Do want to note that that's an ambitious time frame to construct the wastewater treatment plant and get that started this summer. But we have been confident and we continue to be confident that there are options and paths available to meet that timeline. And that was something that we tried to convey in the letter that we sent in December of 2018. That letter also proposed monthly meetings with the city to ensure that the proposed goals and the timelines are met and we meet or we stay within the city's desired time frame. Most recently, our technical staff met with the city staff last week to continue those discussions. We have another meeting scheduled tomorrow. So we're continuing to work with the city to assure that we get the information we need and review those permit application elements to move towards that wastewater treatment plant construction. So again, we've worked very hard to support the location of a true shrimp harbor in Luverne and the other economic development that is leading to the need to reconstruct and expand the city's wastewater treatment plant. And we're continuing to work with the city on that. We've also met with the true shrimp representatives as well to continue to support and express our desire to work together towards this important economic development opportunity. And we look forward to continuing with that effort.
I'm sure there are questions. Thank you for that. A question I have, and I've got a couple documents in my hand from Commissioner Lingstein, one dated the 18th of December. I believe that was from him, or maybe it was Paul Kinman, I guess. And Mr. Smith just went over the whole idea of, and Senator Tomasoni asked how long it takes to get permits, and I sit and I look at the letter from our own commissioner. We and our staff have been working on Trusham for several years in support of this venture over the past 21 months, and specifically to the issue of Trusham's wastewater plans. I'm just wondering why it takes so long, and I've not had a conversation with the people from Luverne, but I can imagine the frustration that they must be going through. Can you comment on that at all?
So, Mr. Chair and members, so first of all, I want to make sure to note that we were also very dismayed by the news about the True Shrimp moving their initial harbor from the city of Luverne. We understand that they're planning to still look at the city of Luverne, but not for this first harbor. But specifically to your question, again, this is a somewhat unique situation, although it does happen on occasion, where a business will come in and they're interested in siting in Minnesota. They're working with us and other parts of the state on what are their overall plans, site evaluation, specifics about their particular process. But it wasn't until fairly recently that I think things were finalized or formalized about moving to or putting that site at the city of Luverne and sending some of the wastewater discharge to the city of Luverne's wastewater treatment plant. So while, yes, we've been working with the city for a long time, we've been talking with the city about, or not the, with the city and also with the company about, the need to consider the nature of the discharge and the fact that some wastewater treatment plants may need to do some upgrades in order to meet that. It really wasn't until September that we received that application for the permit renewal for the city of Luverne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we need to talk about some of the basic issues that have arisen here. And regardless of the fact that regarding the application for a permit, I think the issue that has really risen that has caused the problem for the company and for the city, not only in terms of the True Shrimp project, but in terms of Premium Iowa Pork and other potential development, is the specific conductance rule. And I think as we look at the specific conductance rule, there's very technical descriptions of that, and I'm just going to keep it in terms of layman terms because that's what I am in this field. It basically was developed decades ago that when there was not the ability to test for some of these individual components within the water system. And so the specific conductance deals with the flow of electricity through the water, and electricity flows through the water many times because of the elements that you find within the water, whether we're talking about sodium, bicarbonate, sulfates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what it was sort of a general test that, well, if you had a high level of this, that meant you had some stuff in your water, even though they probably couldn't tell you at that particular time exactly what was there. But over time, we have been able to develop better tests, better testing methods, and as a result, they can tell you how much chloride you're going to have and what your goal is going to be and all the other individual elements that are there. And technically, we're at a point where you could meet all of the MPCA individual requirements, whether we're talking about chloride, sulfates, bicarbonates, et cetera, and meet all their parameters. And yet, at the end of the day, you would still fail this specific conductance test. And I think at the end of the day, that's really what we have has happened here. And while this used to be a monitor-only situation for Luverne, at some point it got put into their requirements. And with the city of Luverne, and having spent 16 years in local government, we are a community that has hard water, and we have high levels of iron and manganese. And so we, by nature, through our normal use, are going to turn out a higher level of specific conductance than some other communities may actually do. We're going to come back to that issue in here in a little bit. And Mr. Chairman, do I have your permission just to continue on, or would you like me to come back to you each time? Thank you. I think as relates to the specific conductance rule, I don't know that there were any specific opportunities or options laid out until at least December as far as that is concerned. And could you, Commissioner, give me an outline of what those different options were as it relates to specific conductivity?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, thank you. Excellent explanation, by the way, of specific conductance and how that works. And completely agree with you that is an old rule, and we actually do have a rulemaking underway to update that particular rule. But, of course, while we're in the process of updating under the Federal Clean Water Act, we have to still address the rules that are on the books. But more specifically to your question, first of all, I do want to emphasize that the City of Luverne does have a specific conductance limit in their permit, and they are meeting it. So they are complying with that requirement. They've done great work to look at that and to look at complying with that particular limit. We recognize that we're looking to update that particular rule, and so given that, some of the things that we have as far as options to look at for the permitting in the short term are, might there be some site-specific or permit-specific conditions we can put in place that recognizes that they're meeting the limit now, so maybe with a schedule about what the timeline would be for the new facility coming on board, that kind of works in then with both the development plans and recognizing that we're continuing to gather additional information and updating that rule. The other thing that I do want to note is we don't know, actually, that specific conductance, that limit would be a problem with either True Shrimp or the pork facility coming into the wastewater treatment plant. That was part of the information that we needed to gather and develop and work through with the city. So while we couldn't say specifically here is the mechanism that we can use in the permit because we needed some additional information to figure out what that specific approach was, we were very confident, we continue to be confident, that we can reissue this permit in a way that addresses the need and the timeline for the city and recognizes the situation with specific conductance.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think that regarding the site-specific standard, I think that there was concern on the part of the engineers involved, at least from the city and company standpoint, that such a process was going to take a longer time period than what they could do. I think we have to remember this project, as was stated, has been specifically been talked with the department for 21 months, and obviously the project has been talked about for a longer period than even that is concerned. I think there was also some discussion about removing agricultural use from downstream water. Going back to why the original rule was determined, it was actually for agricultural purposes, irrigation purposes. And thereby, if you had a high specific conductivity, it was suggested, even though you might not know specifically what's in the water, if you wanted to irrigate with it from surface water, it might not be a good thing to actually throw onto your crops. I also want to mention that there is no surface water irrigation in my area. And the interesting thing is, the real kicker in this is that the water from the city of Luverne empties into the Rock River. The Rock River empties into the Big Sioux. The Big Sioux empties into the Missouri. And all those happen in Iowa and South Dakota. And quite frankly, over there, specific conductivity is not really an issue. While there are maybe some standards, they are at least high enough that they do not cause a problem for companies. And of course, even though as you look at site-specific issues, Commissioner, it seems to me that at the end of the day, you've actually approached a variance, which the agency has said is not possible. I think it's just a glorified way of trying to disguise a variance, and I think at the end of the day, that may or may not have been an option. The problem for the company becomes that when you're trying to finance a $300 million project, you can't afford those kind of regulatory uncertainties, and particularly at this stage of the project. It seems to me at some point in time, at the beginning of this project, the issue of specific conductivity is well enough known within your agency that should have been a highlighted issue so that this discussion could have happened much quicker than what it did. And I think, as I told you and Assistant Commissioner Gauthier the other day, this idea that you've been making progress on all these things, you know, this is the start of my seventh year here. For 6 years, I've had that stated at my table in the office. I've had it stated in front of this committee, which I have sat on during this entire time period. And as I listen to that being stated, I ask you, why should I believe that? I have different cities every year that continue to have problems with their municipal water permits. I have individual businesses that, quite frankly, can't get their final permit and finalize their financing. Actually, Assistant Commissioner Gauthier, the one we've been working on in my district, I had an email from the banker this morning, can we get this done before our SBA financing goes away? And I first looked at that completed project a year ago last summer. And we're still hanging out there without a solution to the problem. I have counties that I have met with MPCA people and county officials on landfill questions that they think they're making progress. And then all of a sudden, a year later, they're back to square one. I have businesses that either move out of my district in the state of Minnesota or they refuse to locate here because of the failure of the department to react in a proper and timely manner. Now, if we want to talk about this issue further, I have a couple other questions, Mr. Chairman. Did the department ever contract with the University of Minnesota to conduct a study on specific conductance?
Mr. Chair and members, the agency did contract with the University of Minnesota to look at all of our what are called Class 3 and 4 standards. So they're a group of standards that both look at protecting for industrial uses and then also protecting for agricultural uses. And yes, that did occur.
And when was that request made, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't remember the exact year. It was many years ago, and that is information that we've been processing and figuring out how to approach from a rulemaking standpoint. I do want to note that we've had some very high-profile and very time-consuming rulemakings around water quality standards that we've been trying to work through. The Class 3 and 4 standards rulemaking has been one of our top priorities for probably the last 6 to 8 years. We did issue a request for comments in 2016, really trying to get that moving, and we received 1,500 to 2,000 comments, negative comments about from stakeholders that didn't want us to move forward with that rulemaking. That didn't mean that we stopped, but it did mean that we had a lot of comments and issues that we needed to work through. That's what we've been working on in the last few years so that we have a really solid proposal that we can move forward and be successful on. And we are looking towards this winter for putting out the technical support information for that rulemaking and then going through additional public comment and peer review, looking to move that rulemaking into the more formal rulemaking adoption.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, it's my understanding that the request was made in 2008 and that the report actually was completed by 2010. Now, as it relates to standards, to rules 3 and 4, let's deal specifically with specific conductance. It is also my understanding that the comment from the university was that the specific conductant rule is an antiquated rule and that the agency was applying it improperly. Do you wish to comment to that?
Mr. Chair and members, I would need to review that report to see if I agreed with that statement or not. But I do want to point out that when we have water quality standards, they're a suite of standards that are intended to protect for a particular use. In this case, specific conductance is one of several standards that, when it was adopted to protect for agricultural irrigation use. When we make changes to those standards, we need to look at that, you know, the range of things that are being protected with those standards to make sure that they all work together. So we often can't look at just one parameter like specific conductance without also considering how we're going to address the others that are part of those standards, which of course complicates the process and results in more scientific investigation that's needed. But we have known for some time, I don't disagree with the fact that these standards need to be updated and that the specific conductance one in particular is something that is an antiquated approach. We have been moving forward on doing that. I recognize that the timeline has been long, but again, we are very committed to addressing that. And in particular to this particular situation, one of the benefits is that we have been gathering a lot of scientific information and understanding that we can bring to bear in the reissuance of the City of Luverne's permit. So if we aren't at the point of having those standards updated through rulemaking, we can still put that information forward through the permitting process in order to come up with a logical and approach that makes sense, knowing what we know now, and also can work with the time frame that they're looking at.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, it seems to me, you know, as in light of the fact that you've known probably at the time the request was made, but certainly since 2010, that the specific conductance rule is a problem. And to sit here in 2019 and say we're working on it does not invoke great confidence in me about the agency. How many rules, how many projects have you affected by the application of a rule that the university says is improperly being applied? How many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars have you cost our communities and our businesses by an improper application of a rule? And I understand things aren't as easy as, well, this is it, this is this, and this, that is that. But at the same time, saying that you're making progress and then saying that you've sat on this for a full 8 years or more without a resolution to the problem, quite frankly, if my cities or if my businesses had scientific evidence that they were doing things wrong and they failed to act, the state would probably charge them at least with malfeasance, at worst with fraud. This is absolutely unacceptable. And as a result of this, we've seen hundreds of million dollars of investment go across the state line. We've seen hundreds of jobs go across the state line. And yes, might there be other reasons for that? Yeah, there could very well be. But at the end of the day, it is the MPCA that bears the shoulder of the main responsibility for this problem occurring. And quite frankly, based on what's been said and based on what has happened, I don't know why we should expect there to be any difference. Because the last 6 years I've been here has not produced any improvement in the overall situation. And so what I am asking you today is that there are consultants on the part of the city and that are working with the city and the company that they believe that they have some regulatory and legislative solutions to solve this problem quicker rather than later. And what I am asking you for, and what I am asking the governor's office for, is that the MPCA and the governor's office work with the city to bring about these solutions. And I'd like a response on this in 30 days, either to me or to this committee at the discretion of the chair. Because I'm tired of the timeline that the MPCA has. It is not appropriate. It is not in the best interest of the state. There is nobody in my area that wants bad water. We drink that water along with everybody else. But we also want our communities to move forward and to thrive. And quite frankly, you are standing in the way. And what has happened here is not just a single scenario. We run into this time and time and time again, and I have had enough.
Senator Weber, thank you for your comments, strong, very strong comments, and in the interest of time here, I would make that request as well from the department, as well as the university study that you said you haven't looked at. We'd like to have you review that. And if at all possible, Senator Weber, maybe you and I can get together about putting this on the agenda again.
Very good.
In the near future. But I think the sentiment is the we start the conversation with how great a job we do with permits and getting them out quickly to one that seems to be a real issue here and a real problem. And unfortunately, the state of Minnesota is going to not benefit by this, by losing some business. So with that, I think we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will report back.
Please do that. Thank you.
If I could, I do want to note that our new commissioner, Commissioner Laura Bishop, this is very much on her radar, and she has very much reiterated and reinforced the importance of working with these cities and businesses, and that's something that she wants to see how we can continue to make improvements. So I just did want to take the opportunity to say that.
And she was in my office 2 days ago and assured me of that same thing, so thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So we'll move on to the Volkswagen settlement. Information on that, you got a fairly quickly here, 11, 12 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, it's still it's in your packet as well. Page 23, I'm thinking.
Mr. Chairman, slide 22.
22.
Thank you. So very quick refresher.
Yep.
The Volkswagen company cheated on their emission standards. They got sued by the state of California and the Department of Justice and the settlement. Every state gets a chunk of the settlement based on the number of cars that were faulty that were registered in their state. Minnesota's in line, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, to get $47 million over 10 years in Volkswagen settlement funds. This money is meant to remediate or to make up for the 660 tons of pollutants that those faulty cars dumped in our state during the seven-year period they were operating. So we did a planning process last year. We talked to you about this last year. We had 13 public meetings and stakeholder meetings. And the consensus of all the people involved was that we should do three phases. So the first grant phase was 25% of the money. The second grant phase was the bulk of the money, 50%, and then the third phase in 24 through 27 will be 25%. The reason for that is that no one was quite sure what the demand was going to be, and so folks felt we should put some money out there and get a feel for what the demand is for various types of replacement vehicles. And we wanted to keep some money at the end of the process because some of the stakeholders advised us that there were some new technologies coming to make on- and off-road trucks cleaner. So we wanted to be able to take advantage of that new technology that will be around in phase three. So we have six programs, school buses, charging stations, both fast and slow, heavy-duty on-road, heavy-duty off-road vehicles, and then heavy-duty electric. I'm going to let Mr. Banky here, Dave Banky, talk to you about our grants and how we've rolled them out. We are in the middle of phase one.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Banky. I'm the director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the PCA. As Commissioner Gauthier mentioned, that we're currently halfway through phase one. Our phase one progress includes the release of the four RFPs that you can see on this chart. They include school buses, the charging station infrastructure, both fast and the level two chargers, and also the off-road RFP that went out for vehicles that you can consider in the off-road, the construction equipment, things like that. We have received, I think, a really good response in a couple different ways. First, in the numbers that people have requested for projects, but also in the emissions that we're being looked at in terms of the reductions through the different projects. The school bus RFP that went out, we had almost 400% over in terms of demand for that. So we've got demand there that as we look at the second and third phases, can look at for additional adjustments there. We also have the fast chargers. Both of those had a lot of demand, and the off-road. One of the reasons we call it DERA, I think, is important to recognize, and that is the Diesel Emission Reduction Act also has funding through the Environmental Protection Agency that we take advantage of with this program as well. So we're able to leverage that funding, and that's on an annual basis. So in our plan, you'll see that come up every year as DERA funding, but that's just because it's on an annual cycle with the EPA's grant funding. So both of those can be connected there. We've got another phase that we're working on, and that is to get our additional RFPs out there in the second year of phase one. We've got a heavy-duty on-road, both any fuel and electric, and then we've got another Diesel Emission Reduction Act combination for off-road vehicles. Those are both targeted for 2019 yet, and we're on track with those. We've received funds for the phase one bus RFP from the trustee. That was a process that we weren't sure how fast that was going to go. As you recall, the Wilmington Trust holds the money, and each state is required to submit a request to the trustee and then get that back to the state before we can enter into any contracts. So we've got received that back on the buses. We're working with the project proposers to get those agreements done. We've requested the dollars for the phase one and two EV infrastructure, and we're awaiting a response from the trustee on that, and we're currently preparing for the off-duty request as well for submittal.
Mr. Chairman, you'll note that those RFPs, or requests for proposals, are scheduled to be coming out, a couple of them during session. We will be sure, as we have been trying to be sure, to make sure that your committee members get notice of that and help us publicize it so that we make sure anybody who wants to apply for that money knows about it and can get access to it. So all of this information we're going to use, once we finish these last three, we'll be able to look back on phase one and say, where was the demand higher than we thought? Where was it about what we thought? And then we're going to have a process with the stakeholders to revise our initial plan in light of that new information about the demand. So we've started talking to stakeholders already about what we're seeing, but we'll be sitting down and doing a number of stakeholder outreach and public engagement to find out what people think based on what kind of response we've gotten so far. As you saw, 125 to 400% more demand for the dollars than we had made available, and then what we're going to get with these last three as well. And then finally, just to rush through this, Mr. Chairman, at your request, we just wanted to say that it looks like our overall reductions in pollutants from phase one are going to be good. 951 to 1,031 tons of nitrogen oxides, small particulate matter, 34 to 55 tons, and greenhouse gases, 21,029 to 33,815 tons. So we are definitely making up for the pollution that VW caused, and we're glad that the court documents have been very, you know, specific on what we can spend the money on, because targeting it to get the biggest bang for our buck on pollution reduction is paying off. So with that, Mr. Chairman, in light of the time, we're happy to take more questions.
Nice to have some good information news here as well. Senator Matthews, and then I have a question as well with regards to the grants over $100,000. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today and updating us on this. I want to ask you about some of the interests that I've pushed before with this issue that we've spoken about before. There was an issue of propane buses that had an interest in being used for this money when they didn't feel like they were getting traction through the agency directly. Mm-hmm. So I had legislation on that. So I just wanted to ask if there were propane bus applications that were coming in and what the status of those are and what the makeup of that might be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Matthews. Yes, you'll see we had 70 applications totaling 497 buses in the first round. One of those buses was electric. The rest were a blend of cleaner diesel, propane, and natural gas. And I'm going to say they were mostly probably propane and natural gas. Maybe a few more clean. A lot of the clean diesel we have already done in Minnesota. So we left the choice of energy source on those applications up to the applicant. So they could apply for whatever they desired, whether it was propane, natural gas, or electric. We think so. I can give you the breakdown of exactly how many of the buses that will be funded, but we're not quite done. We're still waiting for a couple of the applicants to complete some paperwork. And once that happens, then we can announce all of the grants and give you all the data on that. But there were a lot of propane applications.
Your follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So are these the number of accepted applications that you're listing on the slide, or is this applications without indicating if they're accepted or turned down?
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Senator Matthews. This is the applications that we received. We, under state rules, can tell you the name of the applicant, what they the amount they applied for, and the type of buses, but we are not allowed to share any more information as yet as to which are funded and which are not. We can't share that under MMB's rules until all of the contracts have been executed. I can tell you that we're very close to that. We just have a little bit of paperwork with two of the applicants to complete, and we're waiting for them to get that to us, and then we'll be able to announce them all.
Okay. And one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And yes, I would like to see the breakdown more in detail to me. I'd appreciate that. Also, we had this conversation last year on the amount that the agency was able to keep for administrative costs. I almost sold you on a bill that I was pushing last year about wanting to keep that level low, and the agency indicated they wanted to save 10% of the total settlement costs for their administrative costs. So I'd like to know what the amount is that you have been, what the percentage level is that you've been keeping for administrative costs to this point.
Ms. Gauthier.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Matthews, thank you for that question. We have kept our administrative costs in around 1 to 10% thus far.
Mr. Chair, last comment on that. I'd continue to encourage. We've had this discussion and debate before, and when I talk to people about this in my district, it's very difficult for people to comprehend how it takes $4 million to decide how to spend the other $43 million. And I come from a county where there's a very low median income level, and I'm sure there'd be volunteers that would line up to get a higher paying job well under budget that could help get these funds directed to where they need to go for a lot less than that. And this could be more work done for some of these projects that could decrease the pollution that we have even further. So I do want to continue this discussion, please.
Okay. Thank you. So it sounds like a bill is coming. Ms. Gauthier, you stopped by my office the other day and we talked about the, and maybe you can answer this or Mr. Benke, but with regards to the $100,000 limit, anything over $100,000, state regulations kick in. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? Affirmative action, I believe, is what you brought up.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. I did have an opportunity to speak briefly with our grants and fiscal folks about that. I'm going to look it up on my phone. They just got back to me this morning. Mr. Chairman, what is pending for those two grantees is paperwork related to plans they need to have on file with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And thank you. One of the grantees, the paperwork we're waiting for is an equal pay certificate, and the other one is a workforce certificate. Both of those, the equal pay certificate was required under the Women's Economic Security Act that was passed into law by the legislature in 2014, creates an obligation for certain state contractors to obtain an equal pay certificate with the Department of Human Rights prior to executing a contract. I can give you a site for that, too. It's MnStat 363A.44. And then the workforce certificate is under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, Section 363A.36. Organizations that have more than 40 full-time employees in the state of Minnesota at their principal place of business on a single working day during the previous 12 months must have a certificate of compliance issued by the Commissioner of the Department of Human Rights before a state contract or agreement for goods that exceeds $100,000 can be granted. So if they meet those FTEs and if the grant is higher than $100,000, which in this case we had a couple of school bus companies where they were looking to replace multiple buses, so it was higher than $100,000, then they, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act and the Minnesota Women's Economic Security Act, they have to have this documentation in place.
Thank you for that. In the interest of time here, I'm wondering if you would email that information to Ben Stanley, our staff, and get an interpretation from him. I'm quite concerned that the Minnesota MPCA is just simply a fiscal agent for this lawsuit, and whether or not these are state contracts. That's where I have the problem of having to have all these regulations on them, and I'd hate to see some bus company that has all diesels get turned down because they don't have an affirmative action program or things like that. I have to wonder whether that was the intent of the ruling at all, that the state...
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what ruling you're referring to, but I'm happy to follow up.
The lawsuit, the settlement.
The VW settlement.
Yeah, that's
of course. Sorry, yeah. Mr. Chairman. I don't know specifically if the VW settlement discusses affirmative action and pay equity regulation by states, but I do know that there are federal requirements along those lines, too, because I checked with the Department of Human Rights, and they told me that if a company already has a federal affirmative action or pay equity, that will suffice to meet the state requirement, but they just have to work with the department to fill out some paperwork.
Yeah, I don't think it's a real big issue, but it was a concern of mine when I heard
Absolutely.
That. Absolutely. We could clarify that. Thank you. Members, anything else? Nothing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.